This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
You need to listen to what customers are saying is to offer free shipping. Everyone wants free shipping. Head first into that and it works. And then you go, oh, cool, okay, so I'm at this step. So whatever way he was interrupting me.
And the tagline is for when it hits the fan.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 23. It is a Monday, the 16th of April. Tomorrow is my birthday. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but my God, it's depressing. So welcome to the show. Thank you very much for tuning in. This introduction is going to be much quicker than my usual rambling introductions, simply because our guest interview, Cinzia Cosolino. Cosolino is another Italian name that I managed to somehow stuff up. Her interview is a fairly long one this week. I think it goes on for about 75 minutes. So rather than listen to me prattle on at the start, you'd be much better off listening to her. She is the founder and owner of a product called Smoothie Bombs. If you get a chance, please go and have a look at the website before you go to the interview. The website is www.thesmoothiebombs.com. She has featured on just about every newspaper and show that you can think of: Sunrise, Herald Sun, Cosmopolitan, Daily Mail, The Age, Mamma Mia, Sydney Morning Herald, Kidspot, everything. She's been on everything because of the product that she makes, which she'll tell you all about, and they are fantastic. And hopefully we're going to be running a competition so that you can win some of them. As usual, before that, we've got the spin cycle with the usual antics from both Eddie and Patrick. So don't miss that as well. And finally, the usual bits and pieces of housekeeping. Gilberto, who is no longer going to have me assassinated by his various Colombian contacts after giving him a plug last week, is launching his new business, I should really know what his new business is. Is the Podcast Boss. I will get the domain in the show notes, but please go and look at him if you're looking to do your own podcast, because he does a fantastic job with this one. So the Podcast Boss, the Podcast Boss. Now try saying that 10 times after you've had 6 pints of lager. Go and check that one out. Come and find me on social media: LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, or email me at simon@simondell.com. Also come and follow the Instagram account, the Simon Dell Show Instagram account. And finally, please, if you get a chance, rate us and review us on iTunes. That is pretty much it for my introduction. We shall get into the juicy bits of the spin cycle right away. Once again, it is another edition of the fantastic spin cycle. And with me, as always, is the gold medal of
You're unreal.
You know where this is going. Gold medal of co-hosts, Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT, and the wooden spoon of co-hosts, Patrick Condren, the chief political reporter from Channel 7.
I think you find editor is the editor, the word you're looking for.
Chief political editor.
Yes. Yeah.
What's the difference between reporter and editor?
About 10 grand.
In which direction?
Yes, I hear you, brother.
Sorry, go on.
It's terrible when you've got more Twitter followers than salary. But anyway, that's...
on that note, which just to start off this discussion for this week, you have been not quite swanning it around with Prince Charles and Camilla, but I believe you achieved a level of fame on Twitter today that you've never previously attained.
Well, I have, but it's always a nice touch, I think, in this modern day and age when big companies respond. So Chuck and Millsy were lobbed in Brisbane today, and much to the...
Is that what you call them, is it?
That's hilarious. What I call them in polite company.
Right, okay.
Much to my chagrin, because as soon as they enter Australian airspace or sea space or boat space, the Australian taxpayer has to start paying for their overpriced bums to be in this country, which annoys the hell out of me. But be what it is. Anyway, I was at Parliament House. Chuck and Millsy were down at Old Government House, down at the QUT campus just down the road.
They were.
Within spitting distance. Unfortunately, there were too many police. Anyway, in my office, I have a box of Yorkshire tea that I was first introduced to in the Magpie Cafe in Whitby to go with some cod and chips that I was having. Mm-hmm. And I've been a fan of it ever since. This is many, 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 many years ago. Anyway, on the Yorkshire tea box, it had by royal appointment of HRA, the Prince of Wales. So I said on Twitter, I took a photo of myself with the box and a tea bag in a cup, and I said, you know, on Twitter, while I might not be invited to be with Charles and Camilla, at least I can pretend. And I tagged the Yorkshire Tea Company in my tweet.
Right, okay.
And an hour or so ago, the company's responded. They've obviously woken up in the UK, and they've responded and said on Twitter, that's what we like to see. And I just thought that's a nice touch from a big, big company. I presume yes. Yorkshire Tea is a big company in the UK, but they've obviously got this social media team that responds to those sorts of things. They, you know, and I have, well, I've not pressed the flesh with royalty. I've interviewed Tony Blair, but it was still a thrill to be included in the Yorkshire Tea, you know, Twitter account.
There you go.
Well, maybe a bit of a personalised surface.
Maybe service. You could get sponsored by them.
I mean, life's about stories, isn't it? And that's a great story, Pat. And the older
you get.
It's
a good story for Yorkshire Tea.
Oh, it's a brilliant story. And if you want to influence people and influence just their daily lives, because so many people have not only one cup of tea a day, but three cups a day. So you tell a compelling story, you get them involved, and you build a relationship. So it's really, really lovely. It's a great story.
The British apparently consume 165 million cups of tea every day.
Wow. Is that one person or?
Well, if it's my mother and father, they're probably doing 164 million of those every day.
That is amazing stuff.
I know. It's ridiculous. Now, and it's funny you should, because when you mentioned Yorkshire Tea earlier today, I suddenly went, you know what? There's been a story about them in social media recently, and it was an absolute classic, was that a guy called Terry Robinson, who's on Twitter,
yes.
Who is a who's an advocate for Brexit, and he tweeted something. This was back, back in January, where he said, "Good to see at Yorkshire Tea, our fellow patriots. Yorkshire soil makes the best tea."
Oh yes, go on, yes.
And and then it was pointed out by other people that Yorkshire Tea probably wasn't actually grown in Yorkshire, because for those of you from Yorkshire or who have been to Yorkshire know that the weather isn't really kind of
tea friendly weather.
And so they shared back about where Yorkshire Tea was made, which just so happens it's grown in 20 different places across Africa and India, and then imported and blended. So that's why it's called what it is. And Terry Robinson, bless his cotton socks, responded with a tweet that says, "Fucking disgraceful. Why call it Yorkshire Tea if it's not grown in Yorkshire? Won't be buying it from you again."
Oh, stop. Why does it let the truth stand in the way of a good story? I mean, it's awesome tea. It's really strong. I'm with you, Pat. My girls actually got it onto me. They're 20-year-olds now. But they said that this was the tea that One Direction just loved. So, of course, we have to have it in the house.
We had to have it, yeah.
Can you imagine all of One Direction sitting around having a cup of tea before they go on stage? Oh, bless them.
With a nip of vodka in it. But it's scary how on social media, particularly these days, that people can lose control of the story. I had an interesting reaction to a tweet that I put out today, and I'm just a person with, you know, 12,000 followers on Twitter. And I took a photo of a very sparse crowd that was out the front of Parliament House waiting to see Charles and Camilla. And I said, the crowd in their tens, in front of Parliament House, waiting to greet Charles and Camilla. And some bloke went berserk. He accused me of bullshitting and hashtag fake news. And I got into this real, and I said to him, Bruce, I don't understand what your problem is. I took a photo, captioned it with facts, and you're accusing me of fake news. And it went on and on and on. So in terms of what you're talking about with Yorkshire tea and dealing with this bloke who's gone, you know, I'm off because it's not growing in Yorkshire. What sort of a place is this? It was similar with Cadbury.
Yeah.
Recently over Easter.
Yeah.
Cadbury in the UK, they said people accused them of not putting Easter on their chocolate eggs. Yeah. And the people are saying, that's not true.
Yeah.
It's not true.
The interesting, I think the interesting phenomenon then that brings us around to the subject for today was this concept of micro brands. And I think what you've expressed there with Yorkshire Tea, and Yorkshire Tea aren't a micro brand. I think
no. You know,
they're still a big company. But it's an example of how, if done correctly, that social media can be that powerful tool. And the reason I wanted to sort of bring this up was because there was an article written by a guy called Scott Belsky. He was the chief product, or he is the chief product officer at Adobe. He was a founder of Behance. He's a venture capitalist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, smart guy. And his point was that going through Instagram and presumably other social media platforms, he was finding dozens and dozens of what he called micro brands, which were selling millions to tens of millions of dollars of product every year. And a lot of them are, you know, clothing brands and things like that. But they've got very, very small teams. You know, they're sourcing stuff directly from manufacturers in China. They've got a small team that might consist of four or five people. They're very, very active on social media, and they're absolutely making a fortune at the detriment of these big, unwieldy brands that have got retail frontage that they have to worry about, warehouses that they have to worry about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I saw this article today, and I'll share it on my social media, and we'll share it on Instagram as well. But my question to you guys was whether that's the future, is that we're not going to be buying, we're all going to be stop looking at these bigger brands and start picking up on these, you know, smaller, quirky individual brands that are really, really customized and tailored for particular target markets.
Well, you've touched on it before with previous interviews, Simon. You interviewed the Vinomofo co-founder, Justin Dry. I mean, they started out just the two of them, and what was it back in, 2011 in Adelaide. And now they have 50 staff, but, you know, that's 7 years' growth. And a lot of these micro brands that we're hearing about now and reading about and purchasing from, they're little now, and they're little because, as you say, they've got no overheads. They've got no storage costs.
Yeah.
They coordinate with Chinese partners. They ship worldwide straight from where the product is made. And there's so many of these brands that have already been successful, like Who Gives a Crap?
Have you
heard of the toilet paper?
Yeah, we're forever discussing toilet rolls.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Again, a wonderful Australian startup, started in 2013.
Yeah,
they are amazing. Simon Griffiths, Jihan Ratnatunga, Danny Alexander. They now have 18 staff. It was just the three of them.
Yeah.
They have donated 1.2 million already in charity. Like, that's just crazy.
Jesus.
And they go and build toilets in places that don't have toilets.
Yeah.
They're an amazing story. So as well as, you know, the fashion brands and makeup brands and you name it, there's really good stories that are coming out of Australia. That Orange Sky Laundry as well, and they're another brand that two UQ guys, University of Queensland, in 2014 started a mobile laundry for the homeless, and again grown to 10 services. They now have mobile showers for the homeless. Look, it is a way of the future. It definitely is.
I think the key point for success of a lot of these smaller brands, and you know, some of those that you've just used as an example there, Eddie, is that they're not carrying massive inventory and in warehouses. And actually, there's a good example that I just thought about whilst you were talking there of a friend of mine who created, I think 2-3 years ago, he created a coconut water. Now, I don't know if either of you have ever drunk coconut water.
Yeah.
It's an acquired taste. Some people like it, some people, it's like Vegemite. But he's built this coconut water empire, for want of a better word, and he's exporting now to, I think last time I spoke to him, it was 7 or 8 countries or something like that. No offices, no huge amount of staff, no warehousing. It's all coming in containers and then going straight back out to distributors, coming in from Vietnam. So he's only buying what he's only ordering what he actually needs. Perfect, perfect business plan.
Very smart.
Absolutely. And what he's done, I'm going to interrupt you this week, Simon, and not Eddie. What he's done is created a need that is unnecessary. So people, he's convinced people that they need to drink coconut water, and they've gone, shit, where do we get this coconut water? And he's unveiled, he's lifted up the tarpaulin and said, well, as it happens, I have
just so happens here's what I made earlier
of coconut water here.
Yeah.
And that's very clever. I mean, I understand the practical side of what you're talking about in terms of the logistics, but there's also an element of him being, you know, dictating to the market what the market should have.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I think that is as equally as clever as minimizing your overheads and doing all that sort of business. I think that's the way of the future. I think the way of the future is people are going to buy stuff and they're prepared to pay a little bit more for boutique stuff. But if you want bog roll or you want, you know, tins of baked beans, you're going to go to the supermarket, you're going to go to Aldi or Woolies, and that's what you're going to buy. You're going to buy, you know, cheap and cheerful there, but stuff like clothes, shoes, nice food, I think people are prepared to pay more, and that's when they'll start to go into the boutique area.
But if they're sustainable, like who gives a crap, and they're giving so much money to charity and you know, building toilets in places that they weren't toilets and stopping diseases, people have this environmental ethical bent, and that's good, and they can promote that through social media, which doesn't, I mean, digital and social media comes at a cost, but it's not at the cost of mass media advertising. And that's where if you engage with micro brands and I suppose micro influencers, but micro brands, then other micro brands are going to go, oh, Pat Condren, Simon Dell, they're following me, they're watching me, they're hashtagging whatever it might be. So they're going to then dovetail and follow you back and go, well, this person needs to be on my algorithm and I need to be talking and just, you know, interacting with them.
I think sort of just to wrap up that segment about micro brands, I think the key that I'm trying to make here is that, or the point I'm trying to make here is that it's, if you're switched on and you're smart enough and, you know, you're good at social media, creating a $10 million business, be it in clothing or toilet paper or baked beans or whatever it might be. I mean, there's probably a space in the marketplace for a really targeted baked beans. I mean, I'm sure everyone loves Heinz, but, you know, but maybe there's a gap in the market for a boutique baked bean.
Totally agree. We go out for breakfast and have the best baked beans ever. Yeah.
The best, I make the best homemade baked beans.
But for a
nutritious snack,
start your own new business.
Yeah, why don't you start Pat's Baked Beans?
Because I
could see your name on the tin.
I can too.
Because I couldn't be asked.
Your face on the tin like Dick Smith
that's
does.
The thing. I can see that.
Patrick Condren's Baked Beans.
Well, a former colleague of mine who's now working for the Premier of Queensland, Shane Doherty, and I were going to start a public relations crisis management company, and we were going to combine our names, and we came up with Shat.
That's going to work. For baked beans, it will.
No. Listen to me. I can understand the urge to. But Shat PR and crisis management, and the tagline is for when it hits the fan.
I love it.
Anyway. Back to my point was there is, I think in this day and age, certainly what we're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years is a lot of these micro brands popping up. And we talked to my guy who makes the coconut water. His goal is to build it big enough and eventually sell it out to Coca-Cola.
But it's not 5 to 10 years, but, Simon. It's here now. It's like
absolutely. But there's been more and more of them.
It's already happening because, like, Pat has so many followers. If he started the Shat PR or the Shat Baked Beans brand, I mean, research shows, whether it's Nielsen or Edelman, the trust barometer says that you will buy something from people that you know, that not in person, but you know on social media that you trust. Yeah. So
maybe this is a test, and maybe this is a calling for us, Eddie, that between the three of us, we have to come up with a micro brand that the three of us can create and work on together, and I call it the Spin Cycle something, maybe the Spin Cycle Baked Beans. Whatever.
Can we exaggerate that?
We can exaggerate it as much as
Can I not?
But
can I be left out of that discussion?
We can achieve $10 million a year turnover in a couple of years using the power of our influence.
Sounds good to me.
Push bikes.
Really, I'll be interested in the baked beans. I'll be interested in you taking your homemade recipe and us putting it in a can.
Love it.
Easy as shitting in bed and kicking it out with your feet, which is what you'll do after you've eaten a tin of my baked beans.
On that note, having discussed poo,
it's back to that.
Again,
toilet paper
and everything. It's been a while. To be fair, we have got through quite a few of these without discussing shit and toilet paper. But
and we're much the poorer for it.
Yeah, I know. I just want to thank you both again for your contribution this week. It's been an absolute pleasure. And enjoy the Commonwealth Games this week. I'm sure.
Oh, can you think of a bigger snooze fest?
Oh, I just saw Thorpe on TV.
What do they just say? It's England v Australia and be done with.
Because there's a bit of Canada thrown in as well.
Yeah, definitely.
They don't do anything.
Come on, there's a few New Zealanders. Come on.
Is there any sense, apart if you're living at the Gold Coast, there might be a sense of it, but do you get any sense of it in Brisbane that it's exciting? No. Well, can you imagine what it's like on the other? Can you imagine the Americans going, well, what?
It's probably 73 countries or 71 countries, something like that. Anyway.
Yeah,
anyway, thank you very much, guys. I will see you both next week.
Hasta.
I am joined this week by the founder of a product called Smoothie Bombs, which we will find out a huge amount about in a minute. It's a lady by the name of Cinzia Cozzolino. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
Wow, I even did it with a slightly bit of an accent.
You did it sound a bit Italian.
I have no Italian blood in me whatsoever. So welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You've had a bit of a busy day, I hear, today.
I've had a lot going on today, which is quite normal for me. I think I attract chaos and I like it.
Join the club. Join the club. So let's start off a little bit by just finding out a bit about Smoothie Bombs, because I know a lot of people know the brand and I know you're sold in lots of places around Australia. But tell us a little bit about the actual product itself.
Okay, so the product is a smoothie booster that I created because I had a fussy eating daughter in the family, as a lot of us have. I had just finished my degree as a nutritionist and I'd learned all this great stuff about food and what nutrients were great for certain things. And I had my own daughter in home that was really skipping breakfast and not really doing much lunch eating. And just she was a problem child, basically. And so I came up with this idea. Originally it was the chocolate flavor because I thought, she'll drink a chocolate. It'd be like a chocolate milkshake. She'll drink that. So I put all this good stuff in, particularly things like iron, because, you know, teenage girls are generally pretty low in that, and just like put together a concoction of nuts and seeds and things that I knew were going to be really good for her, and sort of it went from there.
So when you were doing that, obviously you've got a nutritional background.
Yeah.
You weren't even thinking that it would be something that would eventually become a product that was sold around Australia?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I was just trying to solve this problem in my own home. And I was consulting as a nutritionist. I had a clinic that I was going to work at. And while I was in there, I was kind of thinking, geez, people really don't know how to eat breakfast. Like, I actually saw the issue more outside my home as well. Like, I thought, there's a real problem here. And then I went back and looked at a lot of research papers, especially in Australia. Like, one in three Australians skip breakfast 2 to 3 times a week. And that to me was shocking.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I can't leave the house without having breakfast. I'm one of those people that just needs to eat as soon as I wake up. So the idea of someone not being able to stomach food in the morning is foreign to me.
Yeah. Yeah. So where do you sell, how many outlets are you selling to at the moment? What's your
at the moment,
reach across Australia?
At the moment I'm in close to 1,000 stores.
Wow.
I am in Chemist Warehouse, which is, you know, that's in every state of Australia. But I'm also exporting already. So I'm in New Zealand. I am in Bahrain, of all places. I'm in this supermarket chain in Bahrain that's doing really well. I'm about to enter the Korean market. I've been negotiating with a distributor there that we've been setting up the product to be suited for the Korean market. So I need to sort of change some of the things on the packaging.
Yeah.
But that's going on. And we're about to ship out to the US.
Wow. Okay. That's fantastic.
So there's a lot going on. That's part of what happened this morning.
No wonder you're busy. What I thought I might do is, because the first question I tend to ask everyone, we just take a step back. What was your first job out of school? What was the first time somebody actually paid you for doing something?
Okay, I was employed as a journalist for the local community paper.
Wow.
Yeah, what I was doing during the last, maybe the last 3 years of school was I was running a rock magazine that was part of the school magazine. I had a little lift out that I created. So I was very music driven. I had, I was a big fan of music. I played in bands. I had a passion for words and lyrics. So that was where I was when I was in my teens and my 20s. So I got a job as a journalist, even though I'd never done official, I hadn't gone and done a degree. It was just like they liked my writing. They got me to write stuff about the community. Often it was music stuff that was going on because I knew lots about that.
Yeah.
And that was the world I was in prior to discovering nutrition.
Does it feel like you had a bit of an entrepreneurial streak back then? Is that something that you thought you had, or just now you look back on it, you perhaps did, but you weren't conscious of it at the time?
Oh, you know what? I was definitely entrepreneurial. I wouldn't have thought that at the time. But here's this story. This is a cute little story. When I was in grade 3 at primary school, I used to buy corn kernels and go home at night and pop them and then put them into sandwich bags and then sell them out of the back of my backpack in the school ground at recess.
How much were you getting for a bag of popcorn?
Hey, you know what? It was 10 cents at the time, but I was buying the popcorn for about 30 cents a bag, and then I was making about 10 of them from each bag. So I was actually making a lot of money for a 7-year-old, or however, I was 8 or something. And I was like that kid in the school ground at recess that all the kids would come running up to and make sure they got their bag of popcorn. The funny story is that I got dragged into the principal's office later saying, hey, look, it's actually, you're not allowed to do that. I'm like, why? Like, I don't understand. Like, I'm making money. This is good, isn't it? And they're like, no, you can't do it. So I'm like, ah, damn.
I was going to wonder how quickly you got shut down there, but
but it was a long time ago. Get on top of you. They do. Yeah. They do.
So back in the journalist days, just out of interest, when you say you played in bands, do you play a musical instrument, or did you play a musical instrument?
I do. I play guitar and I sang as well. So I did that pretty much in my 20s was pretty much a music. My life was music. I was a big fan of Chrissie Hynde. She was like my idol.
Yes.
You know, so I did a lot of worked around the scene, worked behind the scene with music. I ended up marrying a musician and I had two children with him. I'm no longer together because that became really complicated. But and subsequently, because of the lifestyle, I think that's what drew me to nutrition, because I was like, I really got it. People are going to get healthy. Everyone here is just a little bit not healthy. So I always had that passion for food and being healthy just innately. I think also because I would get sick really quickly. Like I couldn't drink much. I couldn't do a lot of that stuff because I just couldn't handle it. So I liked being healthy.
It's one of the things that as I get older, I've sort of discovered my tolerance for alcohol has decreased drastically. And, you start building an allergic reaction to it. Your body can't break it down as quickly as it used to. So you get kind of, congested and all those kind of things. It's a really sad state of affairs.
I was always a really crap drinker. I was a one-pot creamer, And it never suited me, but I kind of really liked the wild boys because I kind of thought, oh, wow, they can do it. And they were attractive to me in the 20s. Right. And then I got to 30 and I thought, no, they're not that attractive. They're just hopeless.
So you went into nutrition. What sort of triggered that? I mean, obviously you saw these people around you that were unhealthy, but was there sort of one sort of defining moment or a triggering moment that sent you off in that direction?
That's a good question, because I was a single mum down living along the coast, and I'd spent probably, the kids were, when my marriage broke down, the kids were 2 and 7. So I went into, overdrive parent mode, doing the things that I knew needed to be done. So I just put my head down, bum up, and worked a lot of jobs and tried to get enough money so we could pay the bills and do all that. But as soon as my kids got to an age where they were both at school and one was starting high school and the other one was old enough to kind of do some stuff, I kind of had that moment that I thought, I need to do something. I need to change my life now, because if I continue along this path, I'm just going to be working somewhere for $20 an hour and I'm never going to gain anything that I want to do. I'm going to have to just sit in this. I'm not going to break free from where I am. So I did have that moment where I thought, what am I going to do? How am I going to double this up, do something, tilt it in my favor, where is my passion, and follow it. So I happened to be walking down the street in the city with a friend of mine, and there was an open day at Endeavour College, the nutrition and naturopathic college in the city here in Melbourne. And it was an open day, and I thought, I'm just going to go in there and have a look at that. And I went in and sat through a couple of the discussions, and I thought, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to actually do this. I like the idea of this. It resonates with me. And so that's how it happened.
When you sat in there and listened to that talk, so there was other talks that you listened to that day as well, was there?
Yeah, they were all about nutrition though, and about doing a degree, getting into doing a degree in health and nutrition, and so when I heard them talk about what the degree entailed and what it was about, I thought, I'm going to do it. Mind you, incredibly naively, I said I was going to do it, because I'd never done any real official schooling. I'd never sat an exam. I'll just give you a little step back. Like I grew up in the 70s, right? So in Melbourne in the 70s was very school. I went to a really alternative school. We had no structure. It's when they started to think, let's give kids a different way of learning. And I went to one of those schools. So I had no structure in the way I learnt. In hindsight now, it probably wasn't a great idea, but, it's got me where I am. But I'd gone back. I thought, I'm going to do this degree. How hard can it be? But I actually, sat my first exam ever at 42. And that was a complete mind fuck, let me tell you.
I can imagine. I sat my last one at 21 and I still have nightmares about sitting exams at 44.
It was insane. And so I was learning about biology and pharmacology and stuff like that, that I think if I were going to, if I was going to be told what I had to do for those 4 years, I probably wouldn't have done it. I think I went in there blindly, which is actually a little bit about the way I work in general. I think that what happens with me is that I don't think that much, and that works in my favour.
Mm.
You know, I think a lot of people that are really deep thinkers prevent themselves from doing stuff.
Yeah.
I'm as shallow as a wet rag. I don't think much. I just do it. And then once I'm there, do it. And then once I'm there, I just go, oh, God, how did I do that?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people that get stuck in the, overthinking things and getting stuck in vicious cycles of thinking things and analysing. And, you know, there's a good argument for just doing something and seeing what happens and then
sort of
going from there. So, and I guess that's where that's got you to where you are now. So what you mentioned the point when that you'd created this product for your teenage daughter to consume. And for anybody that wants to see the pair of you in action, the video on the front page of the website's an absolute classic.
It's good, isn't it?
very fun. Very funny, very endearing as well. It's quite, you know, it's you know, it really kind of shows the, you know, the personality of the brand as well as the personality of you two as well, which is, you know, fantastic.
But we've got an incredibly close bond. I mean, we work together. She's my rock, really. Yeah. And I'm her rock. We help. When one of us is down, the other one kind of helps pick us up. So it's great to work with my daughter. I love it.
Yeah. What point did you realize you had a commercial product on your hands? I mean, obviously you realized that what you were sort of feeding your daughter was working. At what point did you go, you know what, this is something that other people will buy?
Well, I had a few of my friends were starting to buy them from me, and I was selling a little bit of the ones I was making at home through my clinic because I would bring them in and people would try them and buy them. So
yeah.
I was developing a bit of a market on its own through where I was. Then I mentioned the product to a friend of mine that had a cafe, and he said, hey, you know, why don't you bring me in some here? I wouldn't mind giving them a go. I was working at another cafe and they said, we'd love to have them here. We'll try and sell them. So it ended up becoming a product that was being sold wholesale to cafes initially because they saw the value of how quick that would be for when they got bombed by orders and they had to make healthy smoothies. It was like, hey, this is a really good idea. We don't have to have all the little bits and pieces. And
right, yeah.
Whatever staff was on didn't have to think much either. They just drop one of those things in. And so really initially it went from home to a couple of friends to a few of my clients at the clinic and then into cafes straight away.
When you went to the friends first, was that you just saying to them, I've got something that I think I'd like you to test out and sort of give me some feedback on? Or were they asking you about it?
Both ways, because they were interested in, they'd heard about me creating these smoothie bombs for my daughter. They knew that there was something that I kept saying, hey, she's really great now, because they've all got kids as well. So we all talked about, you know, how our kids could be skipping meals. So they kind of knew about it. Then some of them I did trial out, like with that particular cafe. I just said to him, do you mind if I bring some in and make up some smoothies on the spot hand them around to your customers and get some feedback from them? So I was lucky enough to have that. I got some real life customers that didn't know me and me making them the smoothie bombs and them trying it. And then giving me, I actually had a little sheet of paper where I gave them a questionnaire saying, hey, would you love to try this smoothie? Can you answer this questionnaire for me once you've tried it? And all of them said, yep. So I ended up having like hundreds of these sheets of people commenting and giving me feedback about the taste and what they would pay for it and that sort of thing.
When you got that feedback, was it all good? Or were there people going, this is horrible, some I don't like it?
Yeah, some of it. I did get a couple that picked up some points about it, and I took that on. In fact, look, to be honest, I've been making them officially, you know, for customers probably for just over 5 years.
Yep.
And in that time, I have done a lot of changes to suit what the feedback says. I think it's really important. You can't put blinkers on when it comes to something like your product. You need to listen to what customers are saying and really try and create something that is going to make them happy.
You're not the sort of person that would go into a, you know, that goes into a sort of spiral or meltdown if someone says something negative about a product or anything like that?
No. I reckon it's good to know. It's good to know what they think. Sometimes you do get a little bit emotional about something that gets said. Like I often respond to someone that might go, we brought them home and they're not breaking down. I'm like, are you actually crumbling the bomb into your – like sometimes the description, I've learnt that they need – some customers need a little bit more.
Some people are stupid.
So, you know, subsequently, we've made a really clear description on the new packaging. We've done it really clear so they can see it, because that's something that I was getting some response from, because people were thinking, oh, look, I've had so many different things being said to me about what they could be. Like, you know, do they fizz up when they go inside your smoothie? I'm like, no, because they're thinking a bath bomb. You know, no, I haven't got anything in it that makes it fizz up. And we get all sorts of, and people often get surprised when they pick it up and take the lid off and see that there's five little, bombs inside. They think that there's liquid in there. So I think the big struggle has been – well, the biggest challenge has been educating the consumer about what it is.
I would say to everybody, if you do want to see it once again, like a 30-second video on the front page of your website kind of explains it so simply. It's, you know, you'd have to beyond that. If you don't understand it past that, you probably shouldn't be making your own drinks. That's I guess what I want to do, the questions I really want to ask you now is because I want to ask these based on the fact that hopefully there's people out there listening that are going, you know what, I've got a great idea for a product, or I've got an idea for not necessarily a food-based product, it might be any kind of thing. And to me, as somebody who's also sat there for years and gone, oh, I could probably make that and do that, I think the process scares the crap out of a lot of people. And I want to get an idea of, once you realize that you've got a product, so you've got people that like it, you've got cafes that are taking it, you've got friends that are telling you how good it is, you're getting feedback forms from strangers telling you how good it is. Where did you go from there? Where do you move from making something at home to it becoming a bigger product? And specifically, the first question would be, the manufacturing. What was the steps that you took from saying making it at home to actually mass making it?
That was a very big step in my progress with this brand, because I had been making them at home. Then I moved into a commercial kitchen, so I had to do the right thing by the council. So I had a proper kitchen. We were still hand rolling them, and you know, we were starting to get RSI from the amount of balls we rolled. But we got a really substantial order from Dubai, of all places, from the palace in Dubai. And this is my joke. I'm just going to say it. Yep, I'm going to tell you my joke. I can say that I have sold bombs to the Middle East.
Okay.
I don't know if many people but yes,
no.
I have sold bombs to the Middle East.
So how did that order come about? Where did that come from?
Well, I had a small distributor in Dubai, and she was supplying a lot of stuff to the royal family there, and she basically showed them this was the early stage packaging. She showed them, and I only had two flavors at the time, and for Christmas they put in a substantial order, which meant that we had to do a lot of rolling. And I remember I had my eldest daughter who lives in the US. I contacted her and said, you wouldn't believe it, because she really loves Dubai. She had done some schooling there. And I said, you wouldn't believe it, I'm selling to the royal family in Dubai. She goes, Mum, how on earth are you going to do that? I said, oh, we're hand rolling it. She goes, oh, my God, that's insane. I'm like, no, it's fine. And so, you know, she kind of planted that seed. She goes, you just, Mum, you can't scale up. You absolutely can't scale up while you're working like this. You need to get a manufacturer. So I did go out and try and find someone that would do it. And it took quite a while, actually, because a lot of the places I went into, my volumes weren't large enough yet, not for them. Okay. Like, you need to get a good manufacturer, you need to be doing something like 20,000 units of per flavor. And there was no way that I needed that many at that point. So I couldn't do it. I didn't have the money to be able to do that sort of production. And then it was too scary, because then what, I'd make them and then what if I couldn't sell them? So I had to
find, and presumably you had to find, the cash as well. I would find the cash. Cash flow would have been an issue, because they're not going to make it and take the money, you know, 2 months later. Or they want it up front.
No, and bear in mind, I was a single mum. I had money. Yeah. I was very good at holding, at paying my bills and doing the right thing, but I didn't have a lot of excess money at all. So it was me finding a manufacturer that was going to give me a go and believed in the product, knowing that it was going to be a slow start and then hopefully it would improve. So I did, after interviewing a few places and going in to see them, and I'm still with them. I am at that point where I'm pushing it. Like, they've been growing with me the whole way, and we are getting bigger and bigger. So I am looking at the idea of maybe picking up a second, just because it would be good to have the ability to make the volumes that I need without worrying about it. But right now, that's different things that happen. The bigger you get, you have to look at different places to do it. But
when if someone out there wants to go and look for something like that, is that something that you just sat there and Googled? You just went, you know, wholesale food manufacturers. Okay, wow, all right. And you just found them and started going, just ringing them up or emailing them and.
Just ringing them up, asking them about whether they had the capacity. See, mine was particular because I needed something that could roll a ball. Right. So I was like, do you have the capacity and the machinery to do a ball shape and things like that? So you need to know some of the points that you want to ask them, and then they will tell you. And look, I'm looking at larger manufacturers now, and it's very hard to get into the really big ones, because they are, let's look at it in a monetary term, right? So they have machinery and they have them allocated. They have certain amount of runs on each machine that they know will make them a certain amount of money. So when you approach them and say, I want you guys to make some product for us, they look at you in terms of how much money that 4 hours that they're going to give you is going to make them.
Yeah.
And generally they've got them all booked out. So it's very hard to get into a bigger place. You're better off going to a smaller place to start with and then go from there, because, well, the bigger ones won't touch you and you're not going to make that sort of production. So you do need to start from my piece of advice is really start hand doing, making them like I did, really build up that client base so that you've got something that you know that you're going to have people buying them.
Yeah.
Because one is going to do a small run. Like, my smallest run of each flavor was 1,000 tubes. Now, 1,000 tubes is a lot of tubes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, to sell.
The other question, and finding the manufacturers, that's, you know, that's awesome advice. What about the commercial kitchens? Is that something that, again, that you just Googled and sort of knocked on people's doors and said, you know, how much do you use your kitchen for a day? Is that how it kind of works? Or
I did. You know what? I am a very social person. So when I'm out and there's a group full of people, I'm always gasbagging about one thing or another. And really, every time I got a kitchen was because someone just went, hey, you know what? Actually, my very first kitchen I got was because the local bistro bar that's close to my house, we would go there and have some food and drink, you know, once a week. And they, I became good friends with the owner, and she just offered me her kitchen in the mornings. She said, look, my chefs don't come into work till midday. If you want to get in here between 8 and, you know, midday, you're welcome to use my kitchen to start with. And that was like, oh, that's awesome. And I paid her, you know, a little bit of a fee to use the kitchen. And that was a really great initial step out of my house.
Yeah. That's a really
good. Which allowed me to grow a bit more.
That's an amazing, I mean, I guess people don't even think about that, you know, using.
No.
Using empty capacity for things like restaurants and stuff like that is, you know, is an option if you want to go and experiment or you want to go and try things out. No, as long as you're paying them and as long as you're not leaving the place in a complete disaster mess, I'd imagine most of them would be happy for you to for the extra cash and you know.
That's
and
right. That's right. Okay. And it was really a good thing for her to have. Look, she was in there in the mornings anyway doing some paperwork, so she was happy to know that someone else was there, and she knew me because she would see me there regularly. So it was like she was lending me a hand, but I was helping her as well. Yeah. So that was really brilliant. That was a great first step for me. And it's because I asked. Like, you know, it's because I kept sort of going, I'm looking for a kitchen, I need to find somewhere, and she offered. So and then the next step when I got my other kitchen was really because I'd been talking about it, a friend of mine contacted me saying, hey, I've heard of someone that they need to share a kitchen. Would you be interested? This is their number. Go and see them. And then I did. And I liked it. And I'm actually still there. I'm still at that particular place that I did that, like where the kitchen, I'm still here. So this is like it's become my test kitchen and the kind of the warehouse office space.
Going back again, sorry, I keep going back because I'd like to know all these how you did these things. And I think a lot of other people would as well because, you know, as I said
right
at the start there, I think that scares people how you go through those steps. And each one of them is quite a big step. You know, moving from a commercial kitchen to a manufacturer is a big step. You know, moving from one manufacturer to another manufacturer is a big step. They're all big steps for people to be taking. You mentioned the distributors. And again, this is something that's absolutely fascinated me because I worked in the alcohol industry for about 6 or 7 years. And I would see often that, you know, there's a lot of distributors sitting in the middle that helped those smaller brands get reach and get capacity in the bigger, you know, in bigger customers. But also what comes with a distributor is obviously they want to take a margin as well, which is the downside of not selling direct to some of these customers. How did you, you've got distribution in Bahrain, you've got Korea, the US I'm guessing comes some way through your daughter.
The US, the US is an incredible story as well. So I'll tell you about that later.
Let's go the Dubai one, and the royal family one. Where does she come from?
She literally found me on Instagram.
Wow.
So she found me on Instagram, and then we started talking. We did Skype. We met each other. We liked each other, and she was like, "I'd really like to bring your product in. I think it would really suit our market here, especially the expats, and it would really work." So that happened in 2015. We were doing it back then. Then it became hard to import it, so we stopped doing that. But I've now got another distributor here in Melbourne that does the whole of the Middle East and Asia, and so they are bringing much easier. Because in the beginning when I was dealing with the smaller distributor, it was me and her. We would just be – I'd be mailing it. She'd have to get it through customs, pay the duties. And it were always – they were always relatively – there would have been probably 500 tubes and pretty much a mixture, and it was never a massive amount. It wasn't pallet loads. So we kind of managed, but it was expensive. And I think she, I don't think she's running it anymore. It was just something that she really had a passion for, and we worked together at the time. Now with the larger one that I'm with, they literally just put in orders for pallets and I deliver them to their DC, and they do all the international exporting. I don't deal with it all, which is really great.
So there's distributors who can take products from Australia into foreign markets that actually have offices and depots based in Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane, presumably.
Yes, absolutely. There are definitely ones here that can do that.
So if people are out there and listening, and they're either in a position where they want to expand, that your advice would be to talk to some of those distributors and get them to perhaps do, you know, what sounds like the heavy lifting and the legwork on your behalf. I presume you lose some margin in that respect.
Bear in mind, these people have been doing them for a long time, they are moving container loads of food to these places. So for them to put four or five of your pallets in there is much cheaper than you shipping them over with another shipper that's on your own, and you could make a mistake because there's a lot of areas that you could make a mistake and it could cost you a lot of money, in terms of who once it arrives into the docks. The customs can stop stuff. So if you don't know what you're doing with your customs paperwork and you're going, I'll just send it in, you could get it stopped and it can be sitting in the docks for, you know, a week or two, and that's costing you money the whole time it's doing that. So you've got to be really aware. You're better off when you're doing things like exporting, when you get to that point, that you're dealing with people that have done it and know all about it. And I'm kind of dealing with that a bit at the moment going into the US, because the US is very, very strict about how you import food in there, and there's so many rules and regulations and paperwork that you have to do. And, you know, you could be shipping pallets there, and then they could get stopped and returned back, and you just lose that money because you can't get any of that back if it was your fault by not knowing what should have been done.
So tell us the US story then, if it's a good story.
It's a great one. I am a huge, I go to the US once a year at least, because my daughter is studying there. She's at uni. She initially was in Boston, so we went over there a lot. Now she's in California in San Francisco, so we go there. Much easier. And the weather's a little bit nicer in winter too. When we go there, I have a favorite store there called Anthropology. It's a clothes and homeware store. It's like all girls love it. It's just got great clothes. It's a little bit pricey, but it's beautiful. And they have really beautiful homewares, and all their stores are just designed beautifully, and everyone loves them. So we're big fans. And I follow them on Instagram, and I'm very, very, I'm always commenting, I'm always, you know, liking their post and being very active on their platform. So I think that's how they found me, because what happened is one night, I'm an insomniac as well, by the way. I was looking through my emails in the middle of the night, and there's an email from Anthropology, and I'm like, what? What are they emailing me for? And it was basically their buyer said, we really love your product. We'd love to consider bringing these in to the US to be in our stores. We've got 200 stores around the US and the UK and Canada, you know, get in touch so we can talk about it. And I'm like, I jumped out of bed and went and woke up my daughter going, oh my God, Anthropology has just rung us. You know, like I've sent us an email. It was pretty exciting. And so we've been doing backwards and forwards in trying to get the whole process going to get on the shelves there. And of course I had no idea what that involved, because my product is certified organic. You know, in Australia, but of course the certification is not recognized in the US. So, and nor is the I had to basically rejig the whole label for the US. I had to change my packaging basically.
So, right. Okay.
That's what I've been doing the last few months trying to get it so it's approved by the standards that need to be. And we've had to register the manufacturer to be FDA registered. Approved. There's a lot of work. There's a lot of work in bringing food into the US, and they're very strict about what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say. But this morning we literally got the whole go ahead, and we'll be getting the shipment out and to them for summer, which is fantastic.
Oh, cool. So how many pallets are going in that first shipment? What's the volume that they're taking straight
away? I think about four.
Okay. I bet you must be
so it's pretty
extremely
good.
Excited.
I am so excited. And, like, you know, they're not really a food place, but I think they're they're looking at introducing a bit more wellness and stuff into their homeware section, which is great. Right.
And it's normally a question I ask at the end, but I'm going to ask it now. What's the next step for the US? You've obviously got one customer there. How do you go from one customer to 10 customers? Would you put a salesperson in North America? Would you just talk to, you know, encourage the distributors to work harder for you? Where do you go from there?
Well, it's interesting because in the US, I don't have a distributor because I'm going direct to them.
That. Okay, gotcha.
So it's just us. So there's a couple of things I need to do actually in the US to make it work, because what I've got to be very aware of is, like, that's, and I've learned that by being here in Australia, it's one thing to get your product on the shelf. It's another thing to make them sell.
Yeah.
And that's part of
absolutely.
The way you do that is how you market it and how you know, how you get your message across and that education. Now, in Australia, it's 27 million. Is that what we've got here? 28 million. I'm talking about 350 million people.
Yeah.
So it's a whole different strategy of how I'm going to do it. Of course, I'll look at things like Facebook and Instagram. We already have quite a good following of American customers online. We do sell already to them online, and we've got, they're one of the biggest overseas buyers from our online store, but we already communicate with lots of them via social media. It's just a matter of now really homing in and making them aware of the product. And this can happen in different ways. Like, I think I'll have to start going there and doing trade shows.
Yeah.
So that I start to get into more places so people are more familiar. I have even toyed with the idea of Amazon there. You know, will it work? Could I put them on there? Would it be something that would work worthwhile? I think I have to look at the possibility of influencers there, because, you know, they are on those platforms that might help me get people to become aware of the product. You know, there's going to be a lot of work to get the product known there, and I think a lot of PR. And look, ultimately, I would imagine that I would eventually look at manufacturing the product there for the US market in the long run.
Yeah.
If it took off, I mean, when it takes off, should I say?
When, exactly.
When
positivity.
It takes off, I would definitely look at setting up a manufacturer there to do that end of it. It would make much more sense.
Yeah. Look, as we come to the end of, I was going to say we're not near the end of the interview, but there's some questions that I really, really want to get to you before we run out of time. I want to talk about the brand, because I think one of the things that I liked that I saw straight away when I can't remember who it was, suggested I interview you. And thank you, whoever that was, thank you very much. I just want to sort of say how the brand was created, and specifically a couple of things. First of all, the name. I mean, obviously, it's probably not the world's most complicated name in the world, considering what it actually is. But did you play around with other ideas or things like that before you settled on Smoothie Bombs?
You know, the initial product, when I made it at home, when I was calling it, what I was calling it to my daughter, was Nutrition Bomb.
Right.
It was a Nutrition Bomb. This is when we had the raw cacao one. We used to call it Nutrition Bomb. And in fact, the first the first lot that went out into cafes were called, it was called a nutrition bomb.
Right.
And then I wanted to make it even simpler so that people kind of got it. There was no denying what it was. Although, let me tell you, not everyone gets it, even though it says what it is.
I can imagine. We had
this customer come up and say that she thought they were hair dyes. I'm like, how do you get hair dyes from the word smoothie bomb? I don't know.
Oh, God. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So who decided that you'd switch the name?
I think I did. I think I got to that point where I thought it needs to be simpler, and I'm gonna call it what it is.
Okay. And that was no sort of second guessing yourself on that.
It
was
No. I just thought it was going to be really useful. And the product, the actual tube, was another thing that I had in the back of my head for. I'd been thinking about the whole idea of the tube, and I really wanted it. And I originally did some pricing here in Australia, and it was so expensive to get the tube done. It was like $2.50 or two. I think it was close to $3 a tube, and I was like, "Oh, I'm not going to be able to do that because what am I going to charge the customer once I've got the food inside there? It's going to be way too expensive. It'd have to be in the 20s to be able to charge that." So,
What is the retail RRP on it at the moment?
It's $12.95.
Okay. So yeah, $2 for packaging would have been
too
insane.
Much. And yeah. we also originally had them. We were selling them for $14.95 originally when they first came out.
Yeah.
Because this is when we were still hand rolling them and all that stuff. And I thought that's how we priced it. We couldn't price it much cheaper than that. It helped us once we could produce more of them to get the price down.
The question I've got then on the brand is, and again, I stress to everybody, please go and have a look at the website because I think you kind of need to see it to kind of, you know, really understand what's happening. Packaging and brand logos and design, how did that all come about? Was that somebody that you worked with in Melbourne there, or was that somebody overseas, or how did, you know, how many iterations has that gone through, that kind of thing?
Okay, so the original packaging, the tube idea, was something that I had in mind. So I literally hopped onto Alibaba. This is a couple of years back, where the whole process was really clunky back then too. And I just like
– I don't think it's got much easier in Alibaba.
It's a little bit easier. Yeah. Now, before, it was even more complicated than what it is now. And so I went on there and put out a call for a tube. I'd measured the balls up and you know, worked out the height that I wanted and the width that I wanted, and found a company after a few hit and misses who sent me a sample. I tried them out. They fit. Then I had the idea that I wanted the tube. I went and spoke to a graphic designer. I already knew what I wanted it to look like. I had a really good idea about I wanted that sort of splatting of milk, like the flavors and the way and the colors. I'm blind virtually. So I like color. I like colors to be strong. So that's why you can see them. I like them popping out off the shelf. So, you know, I had that idea there. So we basically, I worked with a graphic designer to get the initial two colors right. We started off actually the very, very first one, the chocolate one, was pink, which is a strange option.
Yeah.
I remember we had a little bit of a discussion, me and the graphic designer, because she was saying, oh, no, it'll be really great. I'm like going, it might not look kind of chocolatey though, but, you know, I thought I'll give her a go because it makes sense. She wants it to sort of stand out. And I'm like, okay. And we tried it and people got confused. They constantly thought that it was the berry flavor. And I went, right, okay. Yeah. So within the next reincarnation, it looked like chocolate, which made sense because you got to make things simple. You really do. We had probably from the very first lot to where we are now, we've changed the tube, you know, in little bits and pieces along the way, probably about five or six times.
Okay. So small iterations rather than massive overhauls.
Yes, small ones. Just realizing, if you looked at my very first one, it had a lot of writing on the packaging, and then realizing that no one is looking at that at all. No one, they pick it up and they don't see it. So now we've gone really simple, smoothie bombs, five smoothie boosters. Like, right. That's what it is. That's what they are. You know.
So the graphic designer that you work with, that was just, you know, somebody local or, you know.
Yeah.
And do they still do work for you, or is that sort of you moved on to someone else now?
No, we've moved on. We're not with okay. – we've got another chap that helps us now that literally the poor guy, because I make him work for long hours because he's got his own job, and then I rock up when he finishes work going, I need you to do some changes. Like we've just – we've had to do the US ones, so we've just done the US packaging, yeah. Which is, again, you know, the probably everyone looks at them and they probably look exactly the same to everyone else, but every little detail I know the difference. When it changes.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
The final question I've got for you before we sort of go to my normal final three questions is the marketing. You mentioned early on that it's all very well and good selling a product to a retailer and then putting it on their shelves. And again, I know this back from my alcohol industry days. You know, half of the challenge, if not probably 90% of the challenges, is making the consumer select that product from the shelf or buy that product from a tap or a fridge or all those kind of things. What have you found to be your best channels for, best channels for growing your business to the consumer?
I can say hands down, Instagram has been imperative in the way right. we have grown our brand because we can talk to the consumer. We're very active. We're both my daughter Lana and I are on that platform a lot. So people get to speak to right. us personally. We don't use bots. We don't use programs that respond to things. We literally are there. You can talk to us there, and because of that, I think we've built a really strong, real brand to our community.
I'm just looking at your Smoothie Bomb Instagram account now. 44,000 followers, which is fantastic. Who's contributing to that? Is that you, or is that Lana? Is that you got someone else doing that?
No, Lana does all the posts and she does a lot of the responding. I am the photographer generally. I do all the photos.
Yeah. I was going to say whoever does the styling obviously knows what they're doing. But
That's all me. I predominantly do that side. Lana runs the commentary pretty much. She's the one that they talk to a lot of the time. I've also got my own personal Instagram page, which is Nutrition Darling. So Nutrition Darling is the company that the smoothie bombs are under.
Right. Okay.
So I don't know if you knew that. So that's the actual brand. That's the actual company name that produces it. So I've got my own Instagram page and Facebook page that is Nutrition Darling. That is more about me being a nutritionist. Gotcha. And the foods that I make, and it incorporates the smoothies as well. So that part, it sort of gives that whole concept a genuine side to it. Like you're dealing with a nutritionist. We actually have started putting that on our packaging as well. So created by a nutritionist mum for her kids so that people know that, you know, it's us. That we really make part of the marketing is to show the consumer that they're dealing with a mum and a daughter team. And that's why that video in the front of our website is so important to us, because it's like, you know, that's us. There's no pretending. That's exactly who we are. We drink smoothies every day. I think that's what we try and market. That's part of the way we sell ourselves.
Aside from Instagram, what else has worked well for you in terms of getting that upsell or that increase in sales?
Definitely email marketing. But when I say that, I'm really conscious of not doing a lot of that. Like I say, I think like once a month we will send out an email.
What would you put in that?
We would talk about what is coming out, what's being released. Often it's to our buyers already, so we might have a sale on, or we have incentives for people that bring in a new customer. So there's always every month we have a new incentive, and we have amb- ambassadors, basically, people that really love the brand. Then they get a key ring, which kind of gives, and they've got a number, and with that they can, they get special deals and first ops, you know, they get first options to things that we might have on special and things like that. So we like to take care of our regular customers.
Anything from a marketing perspective that you tried that didn't work and you wouldn't sort of go back and do again?
Sometimes you have to think about when you do your sales and things like that. Like there's, right. like we do, oh, I can't think of anything that comes out. What I found is that when we do a sale online, it's better to put all the flavors on sale. Sometimes when we just put one flavor on sale, thinking, hey, look, you know, this one's on sale, go for that. It doesn't always work. It's better that you put the entire lot on sale. That's a small thing I've picked up.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. It's kind of because we can even pick the really like our best selling flavor. Sometimes I think, hey, you know what? This is our best selling flavor for 3 days. Let's just give it to them at a good price, and then it'll get them talking about it and buying, and it doesn't necessarily work. Oh, you know, and another thing that I find is really, really big when it comes to selling is to offer free shipping.
Right, okay, yeah.
Everyone wants free shipping.
Yeah. It's big on, I think, a lot of you know, when you look at a lot of e-commerce stats about why people buy from certain websites and things like that, free shipping is always a big one. And I think with fashion items, also the ability to return things easily is a big one. Obviously,
slightly
less important for you, but you know.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, but that free shipping is always a trigger. Do you think you'd look at any of the bigger ticket sort of marketing channels later on? Like even, I mean, I guess one of the things that seems to work well for you as well is PR, is getting your face on, you know, a lot of TV shows and a lot of magazines and things like that. Have you done that yourself, or does somebody sort of helping you with that?
I did a little bit of that myself initially, but we did take on a PR company in September, just before, as spring was coming in, and that was magnificent because she did a brilliant job at bringing a lot of the customers to us. She put us in so many different places, and I think certain platforms like social media, we've got it covered. But
yeah,
if you can get on things like television, it's that's got a massive reach. And
what was the pitch? What was the pitch to get you on? I mean, I saw that you've obviously Sunrise is the key one that I see on the website there. What was it? Do you know what her pitch was? Did you get yourself on Sunrise, or did she do that?
No, she did that. And the pitch was basically how a mum on welfare turned her fussy eater story into $1 million business.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That. I mean, again, not meaning to sound facetious in any way, but you know, the media loves those loves those stories, don't they?
Absolutely. So, you know. It's like here's this mum that was on welfare, had no money, came up with this idea because she had a problem in her own family, and it turned into this big, you know, a change of life experience for her.
You hear everybody whinge about this kind of Australian mentality around tall poppy syndrome and all that kind of thing. But to be honest with you, I think the Australian media loves a success story much, much more than they like knocking down a success story. So,
yeah, they do.
I think people sort of forget that sometimes, but you know, it's a great example of how you pitch a story, because you know, I think that's what people want. There's no point in you walking up to Sunrise and going, you know, here I am creating a business and it's all about the product. They kind of want, the product's great, but they want an angle on it. And I think
that's right.
You fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you see it, had that angle for them.
Yeah. And I'm happy. Look, I just think, well, you know, if it's going to motivate a whole lot of other mums that are sitting at home that might have been in the same predicament as me and just don't know what to do, and they're thinking, well, how am I going to change where I'm at? they might hear my story and just go, oh, you know, I've got a passion for this. Maybe I can do something. You know, it's, you still need to have an incredible amount of drive to get a business from an idea to putting it on the shelf. Let me tell you, because there's so many times along that path that you can give up because it's coming, yeah. You're being slapped in the face by the reasons to give up all the time. You know what I mean?
What I would,
you just keep going.
Yeah. What I would say listening to you is, I think what's really clear to anybody that is listening to this is that, yes, there's a lot of opportunities for you to be knocked back and fail and all those kind of things. But what it seems to me is that the way you started, certainly right at that early point, was what was incrementally small steps. You know, you had a product, you gave it to your daughter drank it, you know, then it went to some friends, then it went to a local cafe. Those aren't big steps in themselves. They're steps, but so anybody listening out there could sit there and go, all right, well, I don't have to go from my daughter drinking it to finding a distributor in the US. I just need to take that first step, which is, you know what, invite half a dozen friends around and see what they think.
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely look at it in a way like that. Like when Lana and I walk into Chemist Warehouse now and we see the smoothie bombs on the shelf, we still are absolutely gobsmacked how we possibly have done that. Like, 'cause it was never, you know, to us it was just like, you just put those blinkers on and you put that foot in front of the other. And sometimes you get some setbacks, and so you go, oh God, you know, how are we going to get past this one? And then you might have a day or two that you're sitting around on the couch and feeling glum about it. And then, you know, a little idea comes up and you go, hey, you know what, but we can try this. And then so you go head first into that, and it works. And then you go, oh, cool, okay, so I'm at this step. So let's try and get into the next step, because we reckon we could do this and we can try that. So it ends up just being, I hate to use the word passion, but part of it is your passion, but it's also the fact that you have to be prepared to just go, I'm going to keep climbing over those hot coals and getting to where you got to get.
Yeah. There was another question that I was just about to ask you there, but I've completely forgotten what it was. Got the brain, my brain.
You know what?
I'll be making notes here, and I've got lots of notes.
I'm going to give you a little bit about, because we didn't go deeply into distributors, and I'll give you a little bit of a kind of rundown on distributors in Australia too, which is really important, because I think distributors are brilliant to have because they can get your products out to lots of different places. But when you are a small brand and you have a product like mine, which is not really, there isn't really a market position for it, because it's an innovative product. It hasn't been out there before. The idea of what it is, a pre-portioned booster that you put in a tube like that. So what happens is that people get excited about the idea of it, and so they want to sell it. Distributors, we had a couple of big distributors that put me in lots of stores, and then they, because they had, you know, 2,000-3,000 items on their books, they didn't really follow up the care that something like that needed. So it needs someone to go in and show the stores what it is that it can sell. So in some of the stores, it didn't sell initially, and I worked out that it was literally because that the actual store owner and the staff weren't being told what they were. And so once I went in there and I started doing tastings, I started talking to the staff, even more so than the customers that came in there, because once the staff knows what they are, then the staff will sell them.
Yeah.
So that's what I found out. So, and it made me go, it's really important to find a distributor when you're small. Don't get excited about the really big ones that can get you all those places. Work small first. Find one that's in your hometown. Really get them to have a passion for what your product is, and that when their rep is going into stores, they actually love your product and they can sell it, because you're better off starting small in 10 stores and selling well than being out in all these like 1,000 stores and then them not selling, and then possibly as you grow, they won't take the risk of taking your product on because they tried it and it wasn't at the right time, that sort of thing.
One of the other challenges I found, and this was back from creating an app a few years ago, was that often, certainly in retail stores, and I'm sure it's the same for food-based stores, is that you can go in and you can do a wonderful presentation to the staff as well and say, look, we've got this new product here and we want you to sell it. And the staff get behind it, the staff sell it, they talk to the customer, about the product. And then you go back in 2 months later and all the staff have changed. It's sometimes a very high turnover industry, and you either have to think, well, am I going to go through this whole process again and explain it to a new bunch of staff, or somehow is there a better way of doing it, or is there a better that's a massive challenge, and one that I think it's hard to solve.
Mm. And it's also in my case, look, if I had a product like popcorn or a cake mix or a product that people know exactly what it is, it's a different story because you can put it in. People, if the packaging looks nice, they'll pick it up and they'll give it a go. But when you're dealing with something that people do not know what it is, you really need to have that person that's giving it the love in the store to make customers try it.
Yeah.
Well, that's why something like social media for us has been fantastic because it's made us, we can show them little films, we can talk about it, we keep putting up recipes, we give them enough value for them to go in and give the product a go.
Yeah. I remember the question I was going to ask you a moment ago. I was thinking, so when you and your daughter are in Chemist Warehouse looking at the product on the shelf, have you ever been in a situation where you've seen someone pick it up and take it to the register and buy it?
Oh, yeah, we have.
Did you introduce yourself?
No, we've just stood back. Although the really funny thing is that we go into every Chemist Warehouse and we do introduce ourselves. We just go, hi, that's our product there. We're probably the smallest business in this whole place because that's us,
The staff are in there going, who are these two?
Yeah, these nutters. And you'll probably see us, if you ever were to see us in a Chemist Warehouse, we're probably there doing selfies in front of our smoothie palms. We're there doing little films or, we're always doing quick shots when we're in there because we think it's still really exciting to us, We've been in there a year now. So,
yeah.
But it's still, every time we see it, it's really exciting.
Okay, last three questions because otherwise you and I are going to go on forever here.
That's right.
third to last question is what are some other, you've mentioned Anthropology, but what are some of the other brands that you really like out there? What brands do you admire and sort of potentially go and buy every day or model yourself on or model what you're doing on?
There's a couple of Australian brands that I really like. Like, for example, Emma and Tom's I really like.
Yeah,
I've actually never met them. I know that they're local, and what I really love about them is that they've been plugging at it. They've been doing this whole branding and the whole package has been there for a long time. They're not really social. Like their social media is really small. They've only got like, I think under 10,000 K, which is small for a brand as big as them because they're everywhere.
Yeah.
But what I find with them, what I really love about them is that they've just hard working. They've got their vans that you see. Their branding is everywhere. I really like their branding. Like it's simple and clean and, you always know what you're going to get. I really believe in their philosophy, the way they sell it. I think they do a good job of it. Another brand, I love things like Panna Chocolate. I think he's really done a great job of doing the branding right, and the fact that they really are home in on the handmade, and that's really essential to that brand and how they package themselves, as well as Loving Earth. Like when it comes to food, I look at a lot of food brands, so I do love the packaging and the way Loving Earth has come from being, they were really small and they've slowly just like plugged their way through, and they kind of got there by just hard work and building the brand and growing the products that they have. So there's a lot of them that I like. You know, in terms of there's some fashion labels that I like that I think do a really good job, like Spell up in Byron Bay. They've got a certain look about them that they do well. There's, you know, predominantly I look at clothes.
Yeah.
I mean, at food.
Food.
Food. Food is my main thing that I really look at a lot of the products. There's a lot of them. You know what? There's a lot of small brands that started out when I was kind of growing up through the whole process. And, you know, a lot of them didn't get up to the next level because I think a lot of people get the excitement of getting the idea of creating a product and a brand, and then once they're kind of in there, they realize how much work it is.
Yeah.
And it's an incredibly challenging experience to do. Like
what sometimes goes from a fun hobby into a small business, and it can still be a bit fun, all of a sudden starts becoming serious when you know you have to take on staff and all those kind of things. It becomes
got to know, and there's a lot of skill sets you've got to know to run a business. There's so many skill sets that you have to, like, initially you can take them, you can kind of bluff your way through, but eventually you're going to be hitting this wall, and you have to know, like I always say when I do talks, really do not run away from understanding the numbers of what it takes to run the business. Like, it's passion can drive you there, but you've really got to know what you're doing with the way you manage your finances and what money you put towards marketing and how you plan to grow. All that planning, you know, they all say it's a common thing. You do really have to plan. And I think a lot of brands can get to a certain point and then they crumble because they haven't done that.
What's next for you? Obviously, you've mentioned the US and some other markets. Have you got any other markets to get into? Are there other products on the horizon that you might be, you know, thinking about creating?
Yeah, look, I've had a Muesli range that was out right from the start when I was doing the smoothie bombs initially. I always had I actually used to make raw cakes. I used to make cakes and I had a muesli and a range and the smoothie bombs. So the muesli range really sat backseat for the last 3 years, but I'm going to bring that back out. I'm going to rebrand them because I've got there's three of them. There's a granola, there's a pop grained muesli and a porridge, and I'm going to relaunch them soon. So I've got a little bit more just to make the brand, the Nutrition Darling brand, a little bit stronger. And we are looking at a few more products that we're going to launch possibly before the end of the year. We've got them set up. We've just got to, like, do some tests and look at the packaging and all that sort of stuff. So we are growing, trying to stay within the breakfast brunch bracket. I think I'm staying within that realm. I'm not going to get past the lunch. I'm not going to go to lunch yet. I'm just doing the morning foods you should have in the morning.
Right,
you know, that's
okay.
That's the area that I think needs a lot of help with. When it comes to, I've really done a lot of my focus. What I've done, I find that I'm having to change now is I've really, the last couple of years, I've been driven by what has been coming to me as opposed to what I had planned. So I go one way and then something comes and I just go, oh, that's quite good actually. So I focus on that and move towards that. So what I'm really working on this year is to stay more on track to where I think I need to be rather than react to what is. I mean, the things that are coming at me are really great. So the Anthropology, for example, I had plans to get to the US in 2 years' time, but it's come two years earlier.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say no, but I'm going to be very aware of what, you know, like to keep my focus on what I've got to do here still. So there's still quite a lot in Australia that I need to do. I think I need to look at expanding to more retail here and really strengthening my online presence and that online store, because I think that's a really great part of the brand now, and I think I want to just make that stronger.
Yeah. Okay. It sounds like you're going to be incredibly busy for the next the next 2 years. So
yes, indeed.
I don't think you need anything else other than just get on with all those bits and pieces. So,
that's right.
Last question. If somebody wants to come and talk to you, if they've got some questions they might want to ask you or some advice and things like that, please don't give your phone number out, because otherwise that'll be the end of it. But where's the best place for them to find you and talk to you?
I would say email me would be the best place. So you could email me on cinzia@nutritiondarling.com.
Cool.
So do you want me to spell it, or will that, can you put that up somewhere?
Well, the other place I was going to suggest they contact you would be perhaps through your LinkedIn as well. I don't know if you
LinkedIn. I check my LinkedIn. Absolutely. Cool. In fact, if we're talking about business people, for sure, definitely contact me via LinkedIn, and even you can try me on Facebook Messenger as well, because I'm there most of the time as well.
All right. Look, it's we'll put all those links in the show notes as well for everybody to find. If they want to find you, they'll find you some way.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm everywhere.
You down. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm on all the social media platforms.
Cool. Cinzia, it's been absolutely fantastic, and we went on way longer than I thought we were going to go on for. But that's
I told you we would.
That's a sign of a good conversation. So, really, really appreciate your time. I hope everybody out there has learned. I hope this inspires one person to sit there and go from sitting at home with an idea and actually testing it out with some friends. That would be fantastic.
But absolutely.
Thank you very much for your time today. It's really appreciated.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That is pretty much it from me, from the Simon Dale Show. Thank you very much once again for listening in. Hope you enjoyed this week. Please, if you get out this weekend, try and go and get some of those fantastic smoothie bombs. Test them out. Tell us what you think. Give us some feedback. And more importantly, give Cinzia some feedback and her team there. So I'm sure they would appreciate that. And if you do like them, please tell everyone else about them as well. Other than that, my final request, please rate and review us, as I frequently ask you on iTunes. We'd really appreciate that. Other than that, we do appreciate you listening in every week. For all of those people out there that do, it is you know, we love that you're listening in, and we love that the feedback that we get. So please keep that up. Please keep listening in. Share it with your friends, share it on social media, and thanks very much, and we will hear from you or see you next week. Thank you.